the second tape of Mr. Will Campbell, Nashville, Tennessee, February 14.
Whether you had it on there or not, but
well, that's just,
the thing that really bothers me about the a lot of the younger Negro student movement, when they say, why doesn't the president do something? I had a kid up in North Carolina say the president ought to take over the state patrol, the state highway patrol, you know, and offer us protection in this thing. And why doesn't the Attorney General do more than he's doing, and so on? Really, the system of government that they seem to be calling for here is the same, very similar to what the Minutemen and the John Birchers are calling for, too. A strong man on a white horse.
A different man.
Just a different man. They're talking in terms of a man, but this is something about history I think they don't fail to understand in politics. Too, that this is all right as long as, you know, you had John Kennedy as president, Robert Kennedy as attorney general, but what if next year you had Barry Goldwater as the president, Edwin Walker as attorney general, you know, then you got a little different situation here then. So it's true that the system, the political system we live under, has many limitations and weaknesses in a given situation. This, of course, is what's happening in Mississippi today. Was really on trial is the idea of trial by jury. This is what's at stake there. Prosecution makes an honest attempt to get a conviction, as they did in the Till case. They made a real attempt to get a conviction there. But the jury turns loose. The judge bends over backwards to be fair and objective, as he did in the Till case, and as I understand he did in the Beckwith case, Nevers case. So here's what's really on trial, and yet, if you say, well, let's abandon the trial by jury, well, then what do you take in its place?
You're running an even greater risk in the end, probably.
Yeah. Now, this led me to, this is no consequence for your purposes, but I have a real quarrel with the university at this point.
You mean Mississippi, University of Mississippi?
No, the universities.
In Jericho.
Yeah, that I don't believe they've offered any real leadership. I said this a few weeks ago up at the Tail Chapel at your place, and don't think came out of the pulpit too popular. It'd make a difference. I mean, they didn't pay attention to me anyway. But I think it's true that of all the responsible institutions and culture which have failed, the university has probably failed the most miserably, even including the church. Because all it has done is go out and discover the Ivy League schools now have big drives to go out and discover the bright young Negroes and bring them in. Negro students who are already fit into white values, white society, or else who will fit into it very shortly after they get to the Ivy League schools. I think all the responsible institutions have really failed. Again, not by lying, but by manipulating the truth. The press is hid behind the cult of objectivity, has not offered any real leadership, it simply reacted to crises as they developed. Whereas in the last comparable national emergency, the Second World War, this wasn't true. They offered real leadership, the patriotic slogan, and all sorts of things. They had told to try to rally the people to solve this problem. They haven't done it in this crisis. The church, of course, that's another story, but the university has used the shibboleth of academic excellence, which, is an admirable god. I don't have any quarrel with that. But it is an idol. And if this is all the university has to offer, then it's just washing its hand, too, in the pilot basin of this shibboleth and turning the problem back to the White Citizen Council, back to the Muslims, and say, you work this thing, you settle this thing.
What specifically might they do?
They might specifically, instead of what they're doing or allowing to be done, sending was at Yale, they were recruiting students. Of course, this is not the university doing this, but it is happening on its campus, recruiting 500 or 1,000 students to go to Mississippi for the summer. I don't have any quarrel with this. Free country. They have as much right to go to Mississippi as I had a right to go to Connecticut. And I hope they'll always have this right. But this is not what the university is prepared to do. It's prepared to teach folks and develop leadership. So instead of sending 500 or 1,000 students, it could bring 500 or 5,000 Negro students from the cotton fields, from the every hollow and eddy all over the South and the North as well, from the slum alleys and so on. Negro student, not to prepare them to get into the finest colleges in the fall. Maybe there would be students who would never go to college, who were not even approaching college caliber anywhere, let alone the Ivy League. But to teach them, try to prepare them in the summer, generally, when these schools are concrete tombs, to be the leaders that they're going to be. The leaders are drivers of history. These kids who are coming out of the cotton fields and joining the demonstration and so on, they're going to be the leaders of history, or the drivers. And the university, I think, could do this sort of thing, which then is no threat to academic excellence. You couldn't hide behind that, and yet it's fulfilling a role of developing leadership in a national emergency, which is what we're in the middle of. It could, furthermore, it seems to me, do what they did in the Second World War, when they didn't abandon their standards, but they did bring into being a very creative approach to providing leadership in the crisis and the V-12 programs and so on. The country needed leaders, needed them in a hurry. The university provided them in a very fine way. But as it is, as far as I can determine, the university hadn't done anything except, make sure that it has a few more Negro students and, if possible, a faculty member and see that their pictures are made to get on the alumni news.
Yes, tokenism.
Certainly. Yeah.
There is a problem about getting qualified Negro students.
Of course there is.
A real problem.
Of course there is.
But that's not, you have not done.
This is denied the way, that. This is the way the university has excused itself. I was up at Duke University just about a year ago next month. And one of the men in the administration there said, "Well, Mr. Campbell, we're sophisticated about this thing. We've moved beyond this sentimental approach that a lot of folks are making. You know, and I know, that the vast majority of Negroes in North Carolina can't come up to Duke University standards. And so, naturally, we're not going to have more than a handful of Negro students here after we desegregate in the fall." Well, I said, "Of course this is true. This is what we have created here. This is what the system has done. But does this excuse the university? Does this confine it only to accepting those Negroes who have excelled despite the system, and is, Duke having some Christian ties remaining, is this shibboleth ultimately any more sacred than what the Delta Platter is saying about his field land? What he's saying is true, too, as we were talking a while ago, when he says that these Negroes aren't prepared to go out into society as he defines society. He is telling the truth. He is not prepared to fit into the society as he defines it. And when the university president says these people aren't prepared to come into our community, again, he's telling the truth with his definition of the community.
That is, there are two definitions of the notion of inferior, or two interpretations of the notion of inferior. One is an actual inferiority as of a given moment, and the other is a concept of inferiority, intrinsic, congenital inferiority.
Yeah.
And people play back and forth between those two interpretations, is that it?
Yeah. And they have not done that which they are really prepared to do in the case of the university. I think it's failed and failed pretty miserably, and I think we're going to reap the not enough, again, maybe this is just my Mississippi upbringing, but it's not enough just to condemn the wicked old belt planter when he says that Negroes aren't, when he brings forth his idol, we can of course tear it down. The university can stomp that one right in the ground on sociological grounds, on psychological grounds, on historical grounds, on any ground that it deals with, it can destroy that. But it has an idol too, that again is no more sacred, I think, to the Creator, and no more sacred to history than the idol, the shibboleth of the races.
To shift the topic a moment, as this becomes a national problem, as the thing is dramatized in the streets of New York and Detroit, what effect will this have on Southern attitude toward the Negro, or toward the question of equality for the Negro? Will it have even contradictory results?
Oh, I don't know. It probably would just reinforce the stereotypes and the prejudices and the in those places where the racists are in full control, and that's not many places. It's true in Mississippi. They would probably just take the line, well, see, this, you know, this is what we've been
doing. It's just hell,
folks. Yeah, this is exactly what will happen. And again, when they say this is what's going to happen, we ought to agree with them instead of saying, no, this is not true. The real crisis is going to come, and I think this is already happening. I don't mean to compare Negroes here with the children, but I'm talking in terms of growth here. You don't have any trouble with the child as long as the parent is in full command. But you begin giving him freedom as he reaches adolescence. And that's when the trouble begins. He can look back, you know, when he didn't have this freedom. Now he is free to exert his own will and even begin to lord it over the parent, and he is being an original sinner too, he's going to begin to say, well, my God, it's my time to take over now, and I'm going to run this household. So that I think this can be expected to happen. And here is an era that we're really not prepared to deal with. We're prepared to deal with tokenism, even with desegregation, but I think we're not prepared to deal really with integration, and we're not prepared for the exertion of the will of Negroes as they reach political maturity and power and authority. That white society is simply not prepared to do this. We still think in terms of this is going to be a sort of amalgamation of the two subcultures here that are going to fit neatly together, but the white will still really be running the show, and he will still be doing things for the Negro and so on. I don't think that's what's going to happen. By the way, if you haven't seen it, there's an excellent article by Thomas Merton in the December issue of Ramparts magazine.
I haven't seen it, no.
Well, you ought to get it and read it before you do your piece if you're interested in what a Trappist monk has to say to the world about this thing. It shows amazing insights. I think he talked a lot to John Howard Griffin before he wrote the article, but
now we are back in business. There's some real disgust and hatred built up on that subject of the white liberal. There's a lawyer I've encountered and had two or three sessions with in New Orleans who's a man of high intelligence and good education, and he's worked in civil liberty programs quite devotedly for some time, and with the philosophy of non-resistance.
Yeah.
He said to me in a burst of feeling, I have outreached the point of accepting the black Muslim position. I am even reading their literature now. I don't think the white man is redeemable.
Well, of course, I couldn't agree with this. I continue to consider myself a Christian.
He's not, he said. He
yeah.
ceased to be one long back.
Yeah, well, I admire a man who's dishonest. It's the man, again, who stays on the porch. And this is the real role of the church, seems to me now, how to tell this man to get the hell off the porch or come on inside, you know, and understand who we are here as the people of God. And my father used to say down in Mississippi, and my boys, as long as you're under this roof, you've got me in mind. You're free to go anytime you want to. Door will always be open. Welcome to that. But as long as you live here, this is the way Campbells behave. And I'm the head of the house, and you do what I tell you. It's just that simple, you know. That seems to me a fair analogy of the church here, that if we're going to live under this roof, then we are not free. We don't have any rights. Now, for me to say that I could be born and reared in South Mississippi and be free of racial prejudice would just be a lie. And for me even to say that that now there are not still those vestiges of it within me would also be untrue. But I don't have any choice in this matter. I don't have any rights to that the White Citizen Council has talked about. It's not left for me to decide if I'm going to live under this, in this household of faith. To accept this, and do accept it.
Isn't the problem in general not one of denying prejudice, but of dealing with it in one's own self?
Yeah,
in society.
Remember a little quote I use in this little book from David Lipscomb, who said in 1878, writing to a congregation in Texas, and no one ever accused the Church of Christ of being, of having an episcopacy, of being anything except the most rigid congregational in polity. But he said that when this group in Texas had refused to admit a Negro into their membership, he said that race prejudice would cause trouble in the churches. We know, we already know this. And it did so in apostolic times. And yet, no one ever began its statement by saying, we believe it is sinful to have two congregations in the same community for persons of different races. This was in 1878. And he saw both the biblical aspects of this, and he also saw what you're saying, that it's not the presence of racial prejudice that is really the problem, but how you deal with it. Of course, he saw 100 years ago what Gordon Allport has seen much more recently. There's a lot of difference between prejudice and discrimination. But a man doesn't shrug off racial prejudice simply by intellectual declaration. Just say, well, again today, I'm not going to be prejudiced any longer. I don't have this in me.
I'm going to change the color of my hair.
Yeah. But a man can say that beginning today, I'm not going to deny my brother his rights, as whether he's speaking as a Christian or a humanist or whatever, as an American or a Christian or whatever.
There's a certain sentimentality, perhaps, in the notion of saying, I am unprejudiced. I am totally without prejudice, and you have it.
Yes.
This is a thing you meet constantly. And I can't help but think it's rather comic.
It is comic. And dishonest and all the rest.
And I think most Southerners resent this attitude when they encounter it. one way or another. There's some speculation along the line that once the problem becomes national, becomes acute in the North and the far West, that some Southerners at least, perhaps many Southerners, will suddenly feel themselves in a different relation to the whole problem. They will no longer feel themselves necessarily at the end of the pointing finger of scorn. Mm-hmm. They will first say, sure, ha ha, you got it too. But then say, this is outside of my particular loyalties to a particular section. Now we can transfer the problem. So it's not a matter of my defending a, quote, way of life or tradition or buying a whole package of loyalties, a package deal of loyalties. But look, I'm outside of it. I'm freed from my local loyalties on this point. Does that make any sense?
Well, I would hope that'd be what happened, but Southerners have been Southerners so long, and this has been their self-image for so long, that I don't know, I'm just afraid they'll go on saying, well, you bad as we are, you and the other one.
We'll be bad together.
Yeah.
Strange Lee's position in all of this.
Yeah, certainly is. Certainly is. I'm going to move my chair over here.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
A different relation of Lincoln to emancipation and Lee to emancipation create some problems when you present this to some Negroes.
Yeah, it's interesting today how the among the pros, the segregationists are using Lincoln and the integrationists are using Lee.
That's a very strange shift.
Yeah, it really
very is. Strange shift.
I saw this article the other day, I don't know where it was, but I guess it came from the White Citizen Council on Lincoln's position on, well, it was a little commercial in the Tennessean the other morning, a few days ago. A little coupon, you know, if you want more information, send this to the White Citizen Council. So, and one of the pamphlets was Lincoln's position on the Negro question, something like that.
There was an editorial, but a column in the Jackson paper the other day, quoting from Lincoln, Sheridan, Sherman, other Yankee potentates. They were all racist.
Yeah.
Well, they were, of course.
Yeah.
This could prove many different things.
Yeah.
I think it's a valuable history lesson.
Yeah. Of course, you can take Lincoln as you can take, you know, anything. Take you and prove most things. Position you want to from the things that you might have said throughout the course of your life. I can take Lincoln and quote what he said to Cassius Marcellus Clay on one occasion, sitting out under a tree whittling. He said, "I always thought that those who hold the corn should eat the corn." So if this is my text, then I can say that Lincoln was a great equalitarian. Was not a racist, and so yet you find considerable evidence to support that he was.
Well, you have his meeting after the Emancipation Proclamation with the Negro Committee at the White House, which is quite explicit as a racist. But I suppose the point is the nature of history and the nature of historical process is what's at stake, rather than the attempt at the Citizens Council is now making to use Lincoln as a weapon. As David Potter said to me once in conversation, in 1865 you couldn't find a white man in the continent of Europe or the continent of America who wasn't a racist. Well, this would be very hard to find one.
Yeah.
But
find an awful lot today regarding one degree or another.
But at least there's more lip service to the
idea
of racial equality than there was then.
Yeah.
Do you encounter any reactions to the Lincoln story among Negroes? This change of Lincoln's role?
No, I wouldn't say so. This doesn't reach an awful lot of Negroes. This is not the White City Council audience. They don't. Not that the White City Council audience.
I don't mean from the Citizens Council. I mean from the history books and the way it's taught in Negro schools now.
Mm-hmm.
That Lincoln's role has changed.
Yeah. I never thought about it. I expect there will be a sort of a tactical playing down of Lincoln as the great emancipator. Lincoln is the symbol here. You know, I had Jim Silver in a group every summer. I conduct a human relations workshop for the National Student Association. Then Jim Silver come up a year or two. And of course, he was always been very critical of Lincoln along these lines. I do recall some of the Negro students raising some questions as to, because I think they were stereotyping Jim. Doing so mistakenly, because Jim was not taking the white Mississippi line, quite the opposite. He's just doing what he likes to do all the time, crash the aisles wherever, who's ever there. He used to tell Jim, there's not a damn thing liberal about you. A liberal bone in your body, you just cantankerous. If you were living in Bangor, Maine, you'd probably be organizing a white citizen council.
I'm afraid temperament and toilet training have a lot to do with political positions later on.
No doubt. Yeah, I'm sure this is true.
Well, I don't want to take all your day up.
Well, I don't mind. I've got plenty of time. Stay as long as you like, and we'll go up to the house after a while, see if we'll find a peanut butter sandwich or something.
Wish I could. I've got to get into town to an appointment.
Do you?
Sometime pretty soon, but not immediately. I'll hang on a few more minutes then.
Yeah. All right. George Barrett called last night, and I forgot that he said that if you would like to come in and have lunch with him and a group of labor people, they were meeting about something, and you need not be introduced as anything except a friend of his if you were interested in this.
I am interested, as a matter of fact. I'm staying here at 2, and I certainly cancel with my very casual thing, which was at 12:30. Maybe I should call him and say I'll be on in.
All right. I'll be glad to call him if you want to.
I think I'll do that. Oh, I like to see what this labor gang is like.
Well, you've got some good labor people in this state right now. Matt Lynch, who just recently won the presidency of the Tennessee Labor Council.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Catholic layman, very strong on civil rights and so on.
It's just occurred to me in the course of our conversation.
Switch this off. Not be helpful to your purposes, but it's sort of...
It will be, I know that already.
Sort of sums up what I have to say. It's not a widely accepted position right now among churchmen. And even is, I suppose, considered a moderate position, but to me, it's nothing more radical that can be said on the subject for us. As far as the church is concerned.
That is not to be understood, though, if I get it right, that you are proposing that the civil rights people call off their dogs.
No, not at all, not at all, not at all. But rather the church recognizing that this is really the judgment of God upon us. rather recognizing further, I think, that we've just waited too late to have any real witness in this crisis. There's no point in our rushing in now. If you see a man drown in a creek and you pull him out and you say, well, gee, that's too bad. And then after an hour or 2 hours, you say, well, hell, I'd better give this guy artificial respiration. But it's too late then. There was a time when this was your duty and your witness and so on to give the man artificial respiration. But not now. That time now is to bury the dead, console the widow, try to absorb the grief and share in it, and repent that you didn't give him artificial respiration. But nobody likes to say it's too late for anything. Western prophecy, the 8th century prophets would say it's just too late. Tough, too bad, it's too late. But the 20th century prophets have to say it's too late, but not quite, you know, Bill Graham.
For what?
Not quite. Yeah, we like to say both things. It's really, it's too late, but there's still something we can do. Had an interesting experience the other day in this little group I'm working with here. I don't know how much interest you have in theology. Of course, everybody has an interest in theology in one way, one form or another. I'm not much of a theologian because I think that theology is greatly exaggerated and over-involved. I really don't think there's much to it as far as Christian theology is concerned. But we were trying to draw up those statements. This group that I'm working with, the Committee of Southern Churchmen, which we were just almost paraphrasing St. Paul when he was talking about no longer do we consider worldly standards and worldly distinctions have ceased to exist in our estimate of any man and so on. Then the passage goes on to say, but he has not held our misdeeds against us. And we got that far, about a third of the little group, about 20 people, say, hold on now. This sounds like that we are just off scot-free in this thing. And I said, yeah, that's not only sounds like it, that's what Paul's saying. If you have any argument about it, well, you know, we could never get this. This group wouldn't adopt this. I'm not willing to say that. Still, there is this reluctance to put an absolute trust in an act of God, in a reconciling act of God. There's something we're going to do about this. We're going to work this thing out. Well, here we are. We're not going to work it out. We're going to do what we've been doing. We're going to make it worse. And sure, we can give folks, this is the thing about the church. You say, well, your weakness is that you've denied people voting rights. Well, we'll give people voting rights, you know. Again, the idea of accomplishing simple justice here, which is a pretty important thing if you don't have it. But if anybody thinks that they're going to get real freedom by getting voting rights, they're mistaken. They're not. White folks haven't got real freedom in getting voting rights, or if you think you're going to get real freedom by taking colored white signs off drinking fountains, again, you're mistaken. And again, these are pretty important things. And are certainly inconsistent with our faith, but all I've been trying to say for the last 7 years is that what we are doing is not enough, and it's really not it. I don't mean to be suggesting that it's all right to have white and colored signs up over drinking fountains, or that folks ought to be denied the ballot. But that when you go ahead and society can provide these things, but that doesn't bring about real reconciliation. This doesn't solve the problem. You recognize this?
I'm
sure you did when you were born in Kentucky.
Yes, that's right. Say you do.
Yeah, you know this thing.
you locate the crux of the problem? How would you phrase it?
Well, I would say that, I mean, it would be presumptuous for me to try to phrase it in one sentence, but I would say, and again, I'm speaking as a Christian, I can't talk in any other language,
but I would say, as far as the Christian is concerned, the thing was settled, first of all, was settled at Pentecost, when these people of every nation and race and ethnic group and tongue and so on were all together. This is what integration means. I know what folks are arguing, fighting, killing one another over. This is what it's about, people being all together in one place. But here they were at the birthday of the church. And again, I think St. Paul summed it up and solved it in some of his writings when he kept repeating that the distinctions which the world makes so far as this group, this is a third race, tertium genus. This was an epithet which the world hurled at the church.
Well, yes,
its own.
Yes.
That these people who elect slaves to high office and they don't recognize any of these distinctions, and indeed they didn't, because they had fights about it in the New Testament church. They argued about it, but pretty well worked it out. As far as I'm concerned, this settles it for the church. So that what the little group that I'm working with, the Committee of Southern Churchmen, this is our concern, to get this thinking into the traditional folk religion of the South, which is certainly very strong, and I think very un-Christian. We've got a lot of religion in the South, but not much gospel. But as we can bring gospel to the religion that is so abundant, then I think this is a legitimate, valid Christian witness for us to make. I don't agree with some folks that if the church had been doing its job, well, there wouldn't be a race problem in the South. If the church had really been the church, it would have less influence than it has today, because it'd be so small now that probably folks wouldn't pay very much attention to it at all. It would have been of no consequence. So at least it has a lot of leverage today. It can influence legislation, and it can bring pressures to bear, which is, you know, all right. I'm not blocking that either. It can probably be, maybe be the deciding factor in whether there is a civil rights bill passed or there is not one passed. Of course, I think there will be one passed. But I wouldn't try to sum it up from any other vantage point as to what the crux of the problem or the solution is, because I don't know, as far as the world is concerned, or as far as the whole of society is concerned. No idea. Don't have a great deal of concern. But I don't think the world can really work it out. You know, work this one out, maybe move on to something else.
Well, there's no end to the problem. There's no moratorium on it.
Which doesn't say that we ought to sit still, you know, and be unconcerned with the problems that are put in our path to try to come to grips with it.
There's no moment of Armageddon in history anymore. Well, the great shock the American people got, well, a lot of them got in 65 when they felt they'd had Armageddon.
Yeah.
And the Lord's side had won.
Yeah.
Some people still believe that.
But we really...
Some Yankees.
Yeah. But apparently we didn't learn anything much from that experience. Didn't learn much.
I don't think anybody learned much.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But the nation didn't learn very much from that experience.
But what they learned anything, they learned to keep the lid on as well as possible.
Yeah.
Not to let it get into the battlefield.
Yeah. Yeah, this, of course, is what Ashmore said in his little book, Epitaph for Dixie, that he can envision a lot of things. You may remember this passage, which was quite good poetry, I thought. So I won't try to paraphrase it, but he said, I mean, I won't try to repeat his words, but only paraphrase it. He can never imagine, you know, looking out his office window and seeing General Walker, whoever was, John Casper, whoever was current at the time, inspecting the troops out from the captain, you know, going, oh, boy, this is out. Can't imagine that. But some folks look like this and see that.
Well, they're not realistic.
No, and they don't even want to. They don't want to do that. When they talk about the violence, when the White Citizen Council says that at the last ditch, you know, finally, some of them are beginning to admit that, yes, they would resort to settling it in the streets. But they don't really mean against the feds. They mean against the Negroes, intimidating people and killing them.
You are not going to have any Southern National Guard refusing to be nationalized.
Apparently not. This was this was proved, I think, in Oxford. You had Chippy Faulkner coming out there in the middle of the night with his troop getting hit on the head with bricks, and Chippy Faulkner is as big a racist as it is in Mississippi.
That's Faulkner's cousin, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's his nephew.
Nephew.
When that happened, then you can know that what you say is true, that you're not going to have National Guard refusing to be. Of course, they made this effort in Jackson, sound trucks going around with signs on them just saying, and blaring it out, don't report. No commentary, just don't report. Didn't say report to what, so it wouldn't be an act of treason, but don't report here. But they did report. They fought, and it was in fact they who saved the day. It wasn't the army. By the time the army got there, it was about over.
That's a peculiar position to be in. Being the guard, being nationalized, and those.
It really is. I saw this down Tuscaloosa.
Very educational.
Yeah, when Wallace was standing in his schoolhouse door there, you know, really a comical sight. This little old bandit rooster standing there. Here I am, and I'm in my schoolhouse door. I told you I'd be here, and here I am. And of course, the door was wide of this building. They could have driven a Sherman tank around either flank. Got in, they didn't choose to do it that way, and I think they were right and not choose to do it that way. But the afternoon then, when his commander, General Graham, who was commander of his guard, stepped up and saluted and says, it is my sad duty to respectfully ask you to get out of the door. And he got out of the door. Now General Graham didn't leave any question but what it was a sad day for him, but he didn't leave any question but what it was his duty, and he didn't leave any question but what he meant to carry it out either. And so the governor got out of the door. Which is sort of frightening, you know, really, that military discipline is that rigid and that strong. So people say, well, there's nothing stronger than the racial prejudice. Folks in Mississippi, yeah, their allegiance to military authority is stronger than their race prejudice.
Well, without that, you haven't got an army.
That's right.
It has all or nothing there. There's no nothing beyond that. Troops have mutinied, and troops have turned.
Yeah.
But there's no army.
Yeah.
I don't think I want to live in a country where the troops didn't take orders.
Well, it'd be rather dangerous, I would
guess. Well, I guess I better clear out.
This is the end of the conversation with Will Campbell, Nashville, Tennessee, February 14. Rest of tape blank.